Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone. Help. When I was young,
hello and welcome to Real Recovery. We're so glad you came alongside us tonight to hear an amazing story. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio at his home lake studio facing the lake, which is what he does when he is at his home lake studio. George B. Fraser, a man who, when he was 9 years old, took first place in the punt, pass, and kick competition. And the contract says I talk about that twice a year at minimum. George, welcome.
Hey, thank you, Bill. And thanks for, fulfilling our agreement.
Well, I figured because it's Father's Day, I think it's a good reminder of the fine father you had and who made a big difference in your life and in your recovery. I'd love for you to talk about Bob a little bit tonight.
Well, and it's interesting. My son, Bob, really gave me a nice present today. It's been beautiful. Yeah, my dad, great guy, and I look forward to seeing him again. Nobody yells at me anymore, and I miss that. And my dad was just a great all-around guy. And what happened, Bill, is my heavenly father loved me enough to give me an earthly father who told me the truth. Because if I hadn't had Bob Fraser for a dad, I wouldn't be here.
Mm. Yeah, he was, that's a tough love, wasn't it?
Yeah, tough love would be mild. Bob took it to an extreme.
Okay.
There was no torture involved, but I think that was coming. And, it's hard. It's interesting. I hadn't even thought about this before the show, but I know a guy very well whose son OD'd and died from fentanyl this last week. And great Christian family, great guy. His son was a great guy. I know he didn't intend to do that. And if God doesn't intervene, you can do all the right things as a parent. You can do all the right things and handle it the right way. And things happen and people make their own choices and they're sad. I think the one thing that we can do, Bill, and in this case it was done, is bring your kids up to know the Lord so they are saved. I truly believe you can lose your sobriety at any time, but you can't lose your salvation. Because if you could, you would, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And pretty deep theological thoughts, I can't even say it, on Real Recovery. But that's true. I've been sober a long time, but I know that I'm saved. And that doesn't give us license to misbehave, but it's in God's hands. And some people don't make it, Bill.
I know. And important not only that your kids, raising them, that they come to know the Lord, but that they're discipled, so they really own their faith and make it theirs and not just agreeing to something that mom and dad believe in.
Yeah, it's not like, on your phone, when do you accept? Have you ever read those? I never have. I've lost all my money and everything, and they're going to come take me away. That could happen without the loss of money.
Yeah.
Hey, can we talk about a step here? I've just been rambling. So.
No, that's fine. I just thought it'd be nice to reflect on your dad, Bob Fraser, and tonight. So we did, and now we can move on.
We reflected on Bob more than enough.
All right. We always want to try to cover one of the 12 steps. So we're going to focus on number 12 tonight. Even though the other 11, like you say, George, are just as good. But tonight we're going to look at 12, which is having had a spiritual experience as the result of these steps, which would be the previous 11. We try to carry out this message to others and practice these principles in all our affairs.
Love it. And so a lot of the versions have spiritual awakening instead of spiritual experience. However, there's three parts here, right? Having had the spiritual awakening, the experience, and the awakening referred to or the experience would really be the consecration process, okay? That once you accept Christ into your life, you're going to work on getting holy. It's just not a one and done, I'm good to go deal. And number two is you carry the message. We talk all the time on Real Recovery that God doesn't save you, help you get sober, without having a job for you to do. And you have a purpose now. You have a ministry. It might be sort of your side hustle beside your regular job, Bill. But wherever you go, there's people you can talk to because you've walked the walk that they're currently in.
Mm-hmm.
And I know for me, the greatest joy in my life, and my life is full of joy. I've got a great life by accident. Thank you, Jesus. That a lot of bad golf and stuff, but there's nothing that's better for me than to see a spiritually dead person get saved, get redeemed, get sanctified, get sober. And then they who are dead, I can't see God, but I can see what he does, Bill.
Yep.
And then they carry the message and pass it on. It's what we're here for.
Mm-hmm.
And if you got sober and you got saved, you have purpose. You're part of the team of helping other people get what you have. But you can't give anything away that you don't have. And the reason it's 12 is you got to do the work first. Jesus said you got to pick up your cross and deny yourself daily. And we don't say a bunch of prayers and then not do our work. And Bill, you always talk about non-negotiables that are essential to our recovery. I don't know how it breaks down on what God does and what we do. And I don't want to waste time thinking about that because it's way above my pay grade. But what do I do that's in front of me? Do you pray for sobriety every day? Do you get up and have a quiet time? And are you in the Word? Are you praying? Are you working out? Are you getting enough sleep? Are you helping other people? Are you going to church? Are you in a Bible study? Do you have a recovery group you meet with? Because that's the recovery program, and you get to develop yours. Nothing magical about the 12 steps outside of that they're scripturally oriented and that God designed us to be in communion with him. It's a way of walking out our faith, Bill. And for those of us in recovery, and if you're a Christian, I hope you are, you're in recovery. Your life should be different than it was before. And your program is, how do you walk that out? It just doesn't magically happen and you go about doing whatever you did. Kind of like if you're saved and your life hasn't changed any, you might want to look at that.
Mm-hmm.
George, what do you say?
Well, you came up with a nice list of things that you can use as just a check with yourself. But I wanted to let you know, I heard that as a very happy invitational list. Are you getting up? Are you having quiet time? Are you spending time with the Lord in prayer? Are you connecting with other people in fellowship? Are you getting some exercise? Are you eating right? See, I saw that as a very happy invitational list. Some people might hear it and go, oh, that sounds like a list of a lot of difficult things I got to do if I'm going to maintain my sobriety. And I just hope we can encourage people to say, no, that's a very, very happy and invitational list. It's not a burden.
Well, when you first hear it, it might be, oh, happy to do my homework, you know? And I think what you have to realize here is there's a process. And what happens is things that I know I need to do to get what I want become things that I want to do. Because if any man be in Christ, he's a new creation. You know, we look to Scripture for all of this. Ephesians 4, you have to put off the old, put on the new. And the process is, Bill, the reason the 12 steps work so well, you can stop drinking without them, okay? You can't get saved without Jesus, but you right. can stop drinking without the 12 steps.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not going to be happy, joyful, and free. What the 12 steps do is they help us change by ego reduction. And we replace our ego with God's Holy Spirit in our life. And what happens is he changes the desire of your heart.
Mm-hmm.
And so they do become wanted.
Yeah. And step 12, having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to others and practice these principles in all of our affairs. And I think of Galatians 6, verse 1, that if someone is caught in a sin, you who are spiritual should restore them gently. I love the words, restore them gently. Because as followers of Christ, we can come alongside people who are struggling and offer hope and encouragement and point them to Christ, who is the great lover of our soul and redeemer of our lives.
Nice.
Thanks, George.
What you're saying is there's a way out. And the spiritual experience or awakening, I was dead and now I'm found. There's a process by walking with the Lord that requires steps. And for me, that lines up so well with doing the 12 steps that if something isn't going right, I look at this list of non-negotiables. Mm-hmm. And the reason they're not negotiables is if I don't feel like doing them, I do it anyway.
Yeah,
it's kind of like working out, Bill. You'd never leave the club after working out thinking, gosh, I wish I hadn't done that.
Amen. All right, Georgie, let's take a little break. Happy Father's Day to all you dads out there. We're going to come back and we're going to hear a very powerful story by our guest, Isabel. That's Real Recovery that you have tuned into tonight. Bill and George, Ryan at the board. We'll be right back.
Can get it wrong and still think that it's all right.
Welcome back to the show. So glad to have Isabel as our guest tonight. George, I'm excited to hear her story, as I know you are as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
let's get to it, huh?
Yeah. Isabel, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, we're so grateful that you could make time for us tonight. We're excited to hear about you and your life and what God has done in your life. But let's start with just your growing up phase. What was that like? And when was the first time you sort of had an introduction to either to alcohol or to drugs?
So I guess we'll just start at the beginning. So my story actually starts halfway around the world. I was born in Calcutta, India. And when I was 2.5 weeks old, my birth mom gave me up for adoption. And at the time, that was the best thing she could have done. When they brought me to the orphanage, my stomach was fully extending, and I was showing signs of severe starvation. And so I stayed in the orphanage there for about 8 months. And then that's when my parents adopted me, and that is how I ended up in Minnesota. So, you know, growing up, I had a really good childhood. My parents were wonderful. They were Christians. I think for me, there were always little things. I always maybe just felt a little bit different, but they did a really good job of making me feel like I was a part of the family. I did well in school. I did all sorts of extracurriculars. In fourth grade, that's when things changed a little bit because my dad, he had been an accountant and he became a pastor at our church. And so then I think I kind of took on that pastor's kid label. And at first there was a lot of pride in that, you know, like I felt like, you know, like I had a place in the church and everyone knew who I was, and, you know, it was kind of exciting. But then as the years went by, I think that there was a lot of pressure there, too. I think there was a lot of pressure to be a certain way. And, you know, I did pretty well under that pressure for all the way up till I was about, 13, like middle school. In middle school, that's when I think I started to become really anxious. I don't know if I necessarily had depression, but I was definitely anxious. Mental health has always played a really big role in my addiction and just in my life in general. So when I was 14, that's when my first addiction started. And for me, that was self-harm. It didn't even start with drugs right away. When I was 14 years old, I started cutting. And for me, cutting was a way, it was kind of a physical way to deal with the emotional pain I was feeling. And there wasn't even necessarily anything that wrong in my life. But there was like this turmoil inside of me and I didn't know how to process that. And I didn't know who to talk to because from the outside, everything looked fine. So I didn't understand why I was feeling this way either. So, you know, I kind of pushed those feelings down and I coped with my self-harm. When I was 15 years old, I was sexually assaulted. And I think that that just played even more into my, just into my mental health for sure. And I think it sort of spurred me on to use substances too. Because after that, how it happened, like a lot of girls, I felt like it was my fault. You know, like I felt like I had somehow done this to myself because I had invited this person to be around me, you know, and I thought that, you know, if I told my parents, they just wouldn't understand. So I didn't really tell anybody about it. I just shoved it down. So then about a year after that, that's when I was introduced to marijuana. And for me, at first it was just for fun. You know, I didn't even realize that I was coping necessarily with anything. I just thought that I was doing it for fun, you know. and so I continued to do that for a few years. On my 17th birthday, that's when my mom found some marijuana in my purse. And that was really, I think that was really hard for my parents because I don't think they knew what to do. And I think it was really shocking to them also because I hit it really well. You know, I had straight A's. I was a full-time PSEO student. And I was doing all these things in my life that I was supposed to be doing. And so when that happened, I think that they were just really afraid. I think it's the underlying thing. And that fear sort of came out as anger. And overprotectiveness at the time. So during that time, they pulled me out of my college classes I was taking, and they decided that they were going to send me to my public high school in Cottage Grove. So that's where I grew up, was Cottage Grove, Woodbury, Hastings, that sort of area. And it was sort of a dream come true because my whole life I had actually wanted to go to my school that was in my town, but they hadn't let me. But now, it just was really hard because all they allowed me to do was go to school and then come back from school. And I couldn't really, there wasn't really anything else that I could do. And so then I just rebelled even more, I think. And I just got really angry and I just felt like they had turned my life upside down for something that at the time I didn't think was that big of a deal. I didn't understand then like the implications that, just smoking weed could have in my life in the way that it could escalate to other things. So when they sent me to this new school, I didn't know anybody really. And I made a friend, you know, almost right away. And at lunch, you know, I would notice that like she didn't eat. And I thought that was so weird, you know, because I mean, I was hungry, so I just didn't understand why she was never hungry. And so then eventually I was kind of worried. I thought she had an eating disorder. So I asked her, I was like, Yuvia, do you like, is there something wrong with you? Like, why aren't you eating? And she was like, no, it's just my meds. And I was like, oh, well, that's kind of weird. I was so naive. I didn't know anything about prescription pills or anything like that. And she said, yeah, do you want one? And now that kind of, that was sort of the beginning. I took it originally so that I wouldn't eat because I also had body image disorders and like the way I saw myself just wasn't right. And so I thought, yeah, this is great. This is like a diet pill. I'll just take this and then I won't eat and it'll be great. What I didn't understand that what she had given me was an amphetamine, which is just one molecule away from meth, actually. And so our body chemistry was different. Her, that made her focus. It made her better in school. You know, it did all the things that it was supposed to do for her. This is somebody like me who didn't have ADHD or ADD or anything like that. It just got me high. And this was a different high. Like I had only been high on weed. So this high was different. This high made me feel like I could do anything. Honestly, I felt invincible. You know, and it made me feel like I wasn't depressed or I wasn't anxious or anything like that anymore. Unfortunately, it also made me not want to stay in school because now I had all this energy and I didn't feel focused at all. So I started skipping school, and I started going and hanging out with people, other people that skipped school. You know, we would usually just smoke weed. But slowly, they began to see that I was using something else too. And when I told them what I was using, surprisingly, they asked if they could have some. And then they offered to pay me for it, which was even better. I didn't even know that that was an option. So then what I began doing was I began going to my friend, Yubia, and she had two different prescriptions. And so she would sell me one of her prescriptions. And I found that I could get high for free pretty much if I just sold half of the bottle to these other kids. So then I began doing that. And then my skipping school got even worse the whole time. I was showing up to school was either to get high or to get someone else high or to sell something to someone. And then I would just leave again. And my parents, as you can imagine, were pretty distraught about this. So, you know, they took me all the way down to the Mayo clinic in Rochester so that I could be evaluated because they thought that I was insane because I was acting insane to them. And so they bring me down there and we met with a psychiatric professional and she evaluated me and she talked to me for a long time. And then she told my parents and I that she thought I had something called reactive attachment disorder. Now, reactive attachment disorder, I describe it like this. It's you have a fundamental belief that everybody is going to leave you. And for me, that stemmed from my adoption. So I just believed that everyone was going to leave me always. So my response to that was to get really, really close to people really fast because I thought that person was going to leave. But then when I got close to them and I felt comfortable around them, I would step back and I would push them away because I thought they were going to leave. And that made for some really chaotic relationships in my life. And I don't even think that growing up, maybe it would have been different, like with my anxiety and depression, if I had known I had this underlying factor. But when she diagnosed me, I didn't really care. You know, I was already using drugs and I didn't, I heard her and it made sense to me. But I also knew I had my own solution, which was to get high. So that progressed on. When I turned 18, I moved out of my parents' house. They actually wanted me to go to Teen Challenge, and I said, heck no, and I left. And I moved in with a guy that I had just met a couple weeks before. So, again, those really fast relationships, I thought I loved him. And naturally, that relationship ended up being really abusive, verbally, emotionally, mostly. It wasn't too physically abusive, but sometimes I think that just all the cheating and the emotional pain was even worse than that. So we came in and I was just smoking weed and I was taking my pills still.
Yeah. Isabel, I think we have to hit pause here just for a minute. We have to take a little break, but when we come back, George and I have all kinds of questions for you. It's quite a beginning to a story. Isabel is our guest. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George. We're going to be right back. Welcome back to Real Recovery. Bill, George, we are talking to Isabel tonight. George, what an opening part of her story. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah, a lot of action there.
A lot of action. Yeah, and now we've gotten to age 18, and we're moving in with a boyfriend, and that is not an ideal situation either. Isabel, pick up where you left off, please.
Yeah, so, like I said, I moved in with this guy, and his name was Joe. And I was really naive, and I didn't understand how life worked. You know, I'd always lived with my parents, and I didn't understand that dish soap cost money and toilet paper cost money and all these things that I took for granted I now had to buy for myself. So I got a job, just a normal job, and I started working. And that was okay, But then Joe began to, he began to pick up larger amounts of marijuana. And he was from like the Northfield, Faribault area. And we were living in Prescott, Wisconsin. And so we would drive out there and we would pick up this marijuana and we would bring it back. And he began selling it in Wisconsin because we found that the kids in this town paid a lot more than what we were paying for it. And so then every so often, you know, I would sell my pills still too, but it was mostly just weed. We were just selling weed. And, you know, Joe had told me that in his past he had had an addiction to meth. To methamphetamines, and that he had actually been an IV user, which means he used intravenously, like a needle. And, you know, I thought that that part of his life was just over, you know, so I didn't think too much about it. But then the place we were living, we lost that place to live because the lease was up. And for various reasons, the landlord did not want to renew the lease with us, nor with the people that had been living there before either. So then we were homeless. My parents didn't want to have anything to do with me necessarily. They didn't want to enable me. And so we moved out to where he was from, and his mom let me move in with them. And when I say move in, I mean we set up a tent in the backyard and lived out of a tent. And so, I mean, that was it was summertime, you know, so it was hot. It's not like we were freezing to death or anything. And we went in the house sometimes, but I did live in a tent for a few months in the backyard of my boyfriend's mom's house. And at the time, you know, it just kind of seemed like an adventure, you know, and like it wasn't the best, but it also wasn't the worst. Eventually, though, Joe, because he was back around his hometown, I think he started to use meth again here and there. And then the fighting got worse. And worse and worse. His mom actually kicked us out of her backyard, if you can believe that. And we had to move into a motel room. And that's where things just got really bad. The screaming and the accusations and all the stuff, it just became too much for me. So finally, I called my parents and I was like, okay, I'll go to Teen Challenge. But now, I was only going to Teen Challenge to please them. So I ended up going there and I stayed there for 8 months. Usually the long-term program is 13 months long. So I made it through about 2/3 of the program. And then I thought that I was better. It was my first treatment. I had all these new coping skills. I had, you know, like mental health, work that I had done. And so I made a very foolish decision, and I left Teen Challenge, and I went back to Joe. When I got to where Joe was living, I discovered that he had relapsed on meth, and he had started using it intravenously again, and everybody in that house was shooting up meth. And if I had known that, sometimes I wonder what I still have left. But again, I didn't know. I didn't know how bad it could get. So within 2 weeks of being there, I had started shooting up meth. And that just took my world to a place like I never thought I would go. I didn't think that I was capable even of living a life like that. That was just centered around getting high. And it's such a dark world. Like the need for meth or for whatever you're using when you're using a needle is so strong. Like you're willing to do anything, whatever, rob people, you know, like Joe was selling it like a little bit, not a lot, but just a little. And that was a really crazy time. So he ended up getting kicked out of that place that he was staying in too. So I got kicked out also. And that's when we both decided that we were going to try to do outpatients in Minneapolis because we needed somewhere to go, and we knew that there were sober houses there. And as long as we did outpatient, they would pay for our sober house. That was a good idea in theory, except that we just couldn't stay sober. We got into a sober house, each of us, and we just started using. I got kicked out of my house. He got kicked out of his house.
I got into another house. I got kicked out of that house. And then after that, I ended up on the streets of South Minneapolis. And again, every time, it just blew my mind how I could just get lower and lower and lower. So we were homeless, and I mean, like, really homeless, like sleeping on church doorsteps, running around in the middle of the night, getting high in alleyways, robbing people, stealing bikes, using, like, lock clippers, like, all this stuff, pawning stuff at these pawn shops, just so that we could get high one more time. And as long as I was high, I didn't really care. It took away, it just took away all my feelings. I was pretty numb, and I also sort of felt like I had made this bed, so I had to lie in it. And so that went on for about 3 months. We were homeless on the streets. And then Joe actually ended up getting picked up by the police, and he went to jail. And that was the best thing for me, because that forced me to get help also, because I couldn't be on the streets alone as a female. It would be extremely dangerous. It was dangerous anyway. But so I called my parents again, and then I got into another treatment. And in that treatment, I broke up with Joe. So when I got out of that treatment, I thought that I had figured out the problem. Obviously, the problem was him. It was not me. It was completely him. So now I could go get high again because he wasn't in my life, and so I would be fine. And somehow I actually convinced myself that that made sense. So I started getting high again, but I didn't use a needle. And to me, that was a really big deal because it kind of made me feel like I was better than those other people, the other people that used that way. So then once again, I got kicked out of the sober house I was living in. I moved in with my drug dealer and his dad, and I continued to use meth. But this time it was a little different. I actually built my life up a little bit. I got a 40-hour-a-week job. I saved and saved. And I actually moved into my own apartment on my own. And so now I thought I was adulting. I had never done that before. I was 20 years old, I think. And I felt like I had maybe finally made it. I had figured out how to use drugs and be successful. So I thought. But then God had very, very different plans for me. And I went into something called a psychosis. And this would be the last stage of my use before I finally got help for the final time. So a psychosis is basically meth-induced schizophrenia. You hear voices, you see things that aren't there. And for me, it was completely mind-blowing because, again, I just thought crazy people were crazy and then other people weren't crazy. And so for me to go, to lose my sanity was almost beyond me. So I grasped at straws and different things, like different pieces of reality, but I kept using. And so that just continued to feed the psychosis that I was in. And I stayed in that psychosis for 7 months. And that's a long, long time to be insane for. I also believe that a psychosis is just a medical term for just for a spiritual warfare that's just going on all the time, whether we see it or not. You know, the things I was hearing from these voices were so dark, and they were constantly telling me to kill myself or to hurt myself, just terrible things. I ended up in the psych ward about 5 or 6 times because I completely lost my mind. I was walking into random people's houses in St. Paul. I was just walking around and strolling right on in, which was dangerous too. And these people called the police because they didn't know what else to do, which is a blessing because some houses I know, they might have used me for other reasons and not called the police. So I know that God was with me even then when I was making these incredibly stupid decisions. So at the end of the 7 months, you know, I'd lost everything, my job, all my money, my friends, my family, everything. And I was done. I didn't know what to do anymore. I had ended up homeless again. And this time I checked myself in the detox instead of the hospital. And in detox, they I proceeded to sleep and eat, and that is all I did for 7 days. And during that time, I couldn't figure out why they were letting me stay there, but it was because that was all I was doing. I was sleeping probably 23 hours a day and for 7 days, and eating, you know, three meals. They would wake me up, and I would eat, and I would just go right back to sleep. And then someone in the detox approached me and talked to me about a Rule 25, which is a chemical dependency assessment funded by the county. And right away, the words Teen Challenge came out of my mouth. And I thought that I was never going back to Teen Challenge, but I did. I ended up, I did that Rule 25 with the county, and Teen Challenge accepted me about a week later. So that's how I ended up at Teen Challenge for the second and final time.
All right. This is an amazing story, Isabel. I have to say that there are components that keep coming into this story that are just unbelievable. And yet God is protecting you through all of this. And I'm sitting there listening to your story thinking, if Jesus doesn't show up again pretty soon, I don't know how much more of this I can take.
Yep. And that's right about where I was too.
Yeah. So let me take a little break. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George. Isabel is our guest, and we're learning all kinds of things about what is happening in her life and what God has done to rescue her. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Real Recovery, Bill and George. George, we haven't said much tonight, which I know makes our listeners happy.
It's just nonstop, Bill. It's been fabulous.
It's been amazing, and each thing you hear, you go, okay, that's got to be it, right? And then something else comes in. And I was thinking to myself, and I said this before the break, I need to hear the restorative transformation that Jesus made in her life, because this is a hard story to hear. Very sad.
Yeah, there's two ways this is going to end, either death or we get redeemed and a total turnaround.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming, since we're doing the show, that it's that.
George, you are so smart sometimes. I mean, serious. You should have been a rocket scientist or something.
I'm with you, Bill.
Yeah.
Brain surgeon, something along those lines.
Something, yeah. Decorative bathroom fixture salesman, brain surgeon, something, you know.
Yeah.
All right. Isabel, this is a story, and we're dying to hear the when Jesus came in and transformed this mind and heart of yours.
Yes. So I left detox, and I stayed with my parents for a week until I could get in the Teen Challenge. And now this is my second time in Teen Challenge. So I knew what to expect, but I was different this time. I wasn't the same. Some might have even said that I was broken mentally. And that is true to some degree. But if I hadn't broken mentally like that, Jesus never would have been able to come in and mend that for me, because I wouldn't have let him. So I entered Teen Challenge, and I went into the women's short term, cause you do 30 days in short term before you go to long term. And that 30 days was not easy. I knew that I was in the right place, but there are natural consequences for our actions. And so that first 30 days, I continued to hear voices, even though I wasn't using. And it took almost a little over 30 days, actually, for those voices to finally subside. And I will never forget them or never forget any of that. So then I went into the long-term program, and there, that's when the real work began. I started something called EMDR, which I wish I could tell you what the acronym stands for, but I just can't quite remember right now. But basically, it's a trauma therapy. And this therapy, it uses both sides of your brain. It stimulates both ends, and so the right and the left side. So what happens is you close your eyes and your counselor will, for me, she would tap my hands just rhythmically. And I would just replay the memories, like the most traumatic memories I have in my head while she was tapping my hands. And that does something to your mind where you can almost like remember things that you forgot or work through the things that that you don't remember even. So I had a really great therapist and we did that work for the whole year I was in Teen Challenge. And we worked together and we got through those hard things, you know, those things that, you know, that I didn't really want to talk about that had happened to me. And with that, and then also with just the love and the support from everyone at Teen Challenge, it's not like any other place, you know, it's like, it really is like a family there. And I still consider them my family. So anyway, we can fast forward a little bit. I graduated the 13-month program. And then I went to TCLI, which stands for Teen Challenge Leadership Institute. And that's basically just the next step. It's sober housing with a ministry school attached to it. So you go to these classes and you dive even deeper into the stuff that you had learned. And for me, being a pastor's kid, you know, I had this impression that I knew it all, but I didn't. Because when I had learned those things as a child, my heart wasn't the same as it was when I learned them again as an adult. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that quite makes sense, but it just, everything I heard sounded different to me now. It wasn't like the same passages, the same Bible verses, like they just took on a different meaning and they were actually applicable to my life. And so I stayed there and did that for a few months. And then I got the opportunity to work for Know the Truth, which is the prevention program for Teen Challenge. And Know the Truth goes out into middle schools and high schools in Minnesota and all over Minnesota. And we just tell our stories, you know, and we aren't like the DARE program where they say, just say no. Our approach is more like, I did drugs and this is what happened to me and I didn't think it was going to happen to me, but you can make your own choice. You know, we just hope that like the stuff that we share with them will just make them think a little bit harder before they say yes to that drug or to that drink or whatever it is. Because it's not if it happens, it's when. Almost every single one of those kids will be offered drugs or alcohol at some point. And just to have a little bit more, a little more background and to see the other side of where it can lead, I think is important. Because in high school, it just seems like a party, because that's what I thought it was. But then it spiraled out into this incredibly tragic sort of story that that I just never thought would happen. So I did that, and I worked there for a few months. So this was at the beginning of last year, 2020. And then, as we all know, the COVID-19 pandemic hit. And so the children stopped going to school. And so we no longer could go into the schools and speak to them. And so we did try to adapt and we did do some Zoom meetings, you know, like with the health class. But it was really hard because honestly, getting the kids' attention when you're face to face is hard enough. And over a tablet or an iPad or something like that, it's next to impossible. And so that was kind of an unfortunate thing that happened.
I appreciate all the work that God is doing in your life, and I'd love to hear a little bit more, Isabel, of your personal story and transformation, just because you have been taken such a long distance from where you were to where you are today, and I know listeners love to hear what's going on in your heart as to the transformation just in the remaining time we have left.
Yes. Yes. Okay. So we'll fast forward a little bit through that. The biggest thing, where my heart resides now is still with Teen Challenge. I work in the women's short-term program full-time as a recovery coach. And every single day, I'm reminded again of like where I came from and exactly why I'm fighting for my life now. And being able to share Jesus with these girls is like the best gift that I could have. Being able to, in the things that I went through, being able to relate to them is such a big deal. I've had so many of them come up to me and tell me, like, you know, Isabel, like, Izzy, we wouldn't be here anymore if you hadn't, you know, if you hadn't talked to us, or you hadn't shared. And for me, I know that's Jesus, because that's definitely not me. That was not who I was before. I had no desire to be loving or to work in any sort of capacity like that. So Jesus completely redeemed my life. He turned everything around. Now things are going really well. On top of working full-time, I go to school part-time. I want to work with CPS, which is Child Protection Services. I just want to bring Jesus into that sort of governmental area, because I think that that's really important. Because these kids are put in bad situations, and somebody needs to go in there with the love of Christ to help them. Because helping them on my own or on your own, it just wouldn't, it's never enough. You know, the only thing that can really save them and the only thing that can really turn their lives around is Jesus. And so those are my career goals right now. On a happier note, I recently got engaged in January. And so I have been dating this man named Jeremy for a year and a half about now, and we are going to get married in October. And he is just a wonderful man of God. Like, I never thought that I would find somebody, you know, that loved me and also loved the Lord even more. And he also works at Teen Challenge. He works in the men's part of Teen Challenge. And so we get together, you know, and we pray for our clients, you know, and we pray for each other. We recently joined a church, like as actual members. And that's been really, like a really big deal for us too, because I had always been a part of a church, like my home church, but this time it's different because I know the Lord led me here independently, to join this body. And, you know, we're all one body. But to just have sort of like a home and just know that I'm safe there is an incredible feeling. And so now, I think that my biggest thing is that I just want to encourage other people, just to know that, like, addiction, it doesn't discriminate, you know, it doesn't care who you are or where you came from or what you did before. It will eat you up and it will spit you right back out. But the biggest thing is that Jesus and God will always be there to pick you up. God is so faithful, and I walked away from him so many times, and every single time he was there. And now he has blessed me, and I'm beyond blessed. The restoration I have with my family is a miracle in itself. The fact that I am even here sitting at my parents' house alone watching their house is a really big deal for me, that they trust me enough, you know. And so, I think, you know, my desire and my hope is just to spread that and just let everybody know that it doesn't matter where you are. Jesus, God is going to meet you right there. And it doesn't matter really what you even say or do, because he will speak for you and he'll speak to you. And I know in my life that I have evidence that that's happened.
Isabel, that's quite a story. And I'm delighted that you're able to tell your story as you're sitting in your parents' house, quite a Father's Day present for your dad. So thank you so much for sharing your story and taking time to be with George and I tonight. We've had just a wonderful time learning about you and your story and what God has done in your life. So thank you for doing that.
Yeah.
All right. Course. Georgie, that's all the time we have for tonight. That wraps up another award-winning episode of Road Recovery. So glad that you spent time with us tonight. I hope you have a great week, and God willing, we'll see you next week. Have a great night.
Never meant to do those things to you, and so I have to say before I go.
Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.